Today is the first briefing of the Women's Commission's report entitled Lost from Home, the Lost Boys and Girls from Central America. This report is a continuation of work that the Women's Commission did in 2008 and 2009 that actually I and many other ORIC lawyers participated in, where we visited over 20 detention centers where unaccompanied children were held. That work culminated in the Women's Commission's report, Halfway Home. The Women's Commission does really important work in the area of detention and asylum under Michelle Branne's leadership, whom you'll hear from. Their work has been really instrumental in passing legislation and making changes in policy and practices that have improved the lives of unaccompanied children and families in immigration detention. Nonetheless, as you'll hear from them today, much work remains to be done. We're very excited to have as our moderator today Anita Cashew. Anita is an independent consultant providing a range of consulting services in the area of migration, human rights, and justice reform for nonprofit organizations, international organizations, and foundations. Ms. Cashew was the founding director of the Vera Institute of Justice's Center on Immigration and Justice, which oversees the Unaccompanied Children Program, a national effort to increase legal representation for unaccompanied minors in the custody of the federal government. In September 2007, she left Vera to begin a nine-month stint as a Fulbright Scholar, studying the migration of Central American unaccompanied minors in Mexico and the process of their arrest, detention, and deportation. She was later selected as a visiting researcher at the Center for Inter-American Studies and Programs at Autonomous Technological Institute of Mexico, where she continued her research on unaccompanied minors. Anita is a board member of the Mexico City-based Institute for Women in Migration. Anita?
Thank you. Thanks for that introduction. And thank you, everyone, for being here. I was asked to just give you a little bit of background to put this piece of work, very important piece of work, in context and sort of set up why it's so important that the Women's Commission did this piece of work. In 2012, we've seen almost a doubling of the number of unaccompanied children who have been apprehended in the United States, detained, and put into deportation proceedings. Unaccompanied children, for those of you who are not familiar with the term, are children under the age of 18 with no legal status in the United States and with no parent or guardian looking out for their interests here in the United States. The largest percentage of these, the unaccompanied minors that are in our immigration removal system, are of Central American origin. And so, in other words, they have made the journey from their Central American countries, most commonly Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and they made it through Mexico and then across the U.S. border and are apprehended, most often entering the United States. The majority of these kids are between 14 and 17 years old. There's probably a majority of boys, but I think very, very high percentage of girls as well. So why is this trend of doubling so important? I think it's a very disturbing trend because of the context of the danger that they endure in order to come here to the United States. I think it's very important to keep that in mind. U.S. immigration enforcement policy and the building up of our enforcement policy has sort of funneled migrants into some of the most dangerous ways of coming into the United States, crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. It's almost you see a funneling. As that has resulted in a lot more deaths and a lot more danger for these kids. Also, most of these kids, like I said, are Central American, and they've come up through Mexico, which is, according to many people, feel is even a more dangerous journey than the crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. They endure enormous hardships, enormous dangers. There are thousands and thousands of kidnappings of migrants every year in Mexico. They take a treacherous journey on top of trains sometimes, oftentimes, which puts them at risk of falling off the train, losing limbs, losing lives. There's an enormous amount of sexual assault in the against women and girls, but also boys in the journey up. from Mexico. You know, so this is, you know, one shelter. I once spoke to the head of a shelter in the state of Chiapas, which is just barely crossing into Mexico. It's the southernmost part of Mexico. And 6 out of 10 women or girls he interviewed had been sexually assaulted. So this is an extremely dangerous journey, similar to the United States. Mexico has increased their enforcement of their immigration laws, and as a result, these kids are taking even more dangers in coming up here. It's really quite disturbing. And similar to the United States, Mexico's seen an increase of about 51% increase in deportations of unaccompanied minors from Mexico. So this is a problem. I recently was in Mexico and in Guatemala. This is a problem that people are talking about all throughout the region. People are very worried about it. And so I think it's extremely important that the Women's Commission did this piece of work. I'm so impressed with it, to be honest. I'm very impressed with this piece of work because there was a flurry of sort of emailing and conversations that were happening as we saw this kind of very rapid buildup of increase in the numbers of kids that are in detention, that are being deported or in deportation proceedings. In Mexico as well, there was this big conversation about what's going on here while other numbers are going down. You know, the numbers of adults perhaps are the numbers of kids are growing and growing. And I think there was a lot of rumors that were going around about theories about why this was happening. I see prominent national newspapers publish incorrect theories based on zero evidence. And I'm just so impressed that so quickly, within a few months, the Women's Commission could get it together. I mean, which is really hard for nonprofits these days. Nonprofits typically do not have the bandwidth to just get it together like they did. Get it together and gather some evidence to try to figure out what is going on here. You know, why are we seeing this major increase in numbers of kids being apprehended? And I'm sure they probably wouldn't have been able to do it without the help of Orrick, Harrington, Sutcliffe. So I think it's really impressive partnership. And I am just really thankful that you put together this report so quickly. And I also think one thing that really comes through in this report is that, you know, this is not just an immigration enforcement problem. This is not a migration problem only. This is a humanitarian crisis we're facing. Kids are fleeing Central American countries for lots of reasons, including the violence, poverty. And I think it's time we start treating it as the humanitarian crisis that it is. I also found it a bit disturbing, the finding in the report that this is sort of the new normal, that these numbers are probably here to stay for a little while. And so we need to start thinking long term about how to solve this problem. And I think the report does a good job suggesting some ways to do that. So I think this is just a great piece of work, and thank you so much for inviting me to moderate this panel. I just wanted to also just let you all know that this conversation is being recorded, video recorded, so just be aware of that. I want to introduce our speakers now. Michelle Bernay, who's the director of the Detention and Asylum Program at the Women's Commission. She is, I've known her for years, and she has been focused on this issue of unaccompanied children for as long as I can remember, and she's been an amazing advocate on behalf of unaccompanied minors and other, you know, and women in detention. I can't think of a person more well-informed to lead this discussion off. So without further ado, I will pass it along to Michelle, but also just to let you know that we also have Jeffrey Cox, who's here on the video somewhere.
Hi, Jeffrey. Everyone.
Jeffrey is a senior associate at ORIC's Seattle office and a member of their intellectual property group and internet safety, security, and privacy group. He was heavily involved in gathering data for this report. He's years ago was a Peace Corps volunteer in Honduras, so he's familiar with the region. And he devotes a portion of his practice to providing pro bono services related to domestic violence and immigration law issues. And so thank you also for being here. I think it's, like I said, I think it's really an important partnership that you guys have developed with ORIC, and it really allows you to do, I think, pick up quickly on this very important issue. So without further ado, pass it to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Anita, for that excellent introduction. I do want to start by thanking Equal Justice Works. Jessica Jones, who unfortunately is unable to be here today because she is quite ill, is the principal author of this report, along with Jennifer Podkel, who is on maternity leave. So the two main drafters are unable to be here, but I hope that I can do it justice. Jessica Jones is an Equal Justice Works Fellow with us, and she's supported by the firm of Steptoe & Johnson. So I really want to thank them, because without both of those groups, this report would not have been possible. And then, of course, I want to reiterate the thank you to Kathy Frost and Renee Katawala and Jeffrey and everybody here at ORIC, Harrington Sutcliffe, for their support over the years. Many years ago, they did an extensive body of research and a report called that was called Halfway Home with us. And as Kathy mentioned, they helped us go to over 20 facilities to interview hundreds and hundreds of children individually in that case. It was a really big project. And that report is actually now used as a manual for a lot of people working with unaccompanied children. So it's been really a great partnership. As you heard, this fiscal year has seen an unprecedented number of unaccompanied children arriving in the United States, and in particular into ORR custody. ORR is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Go ahead and raise your hand if I'm saying acronyms that aren't making sense to you. I'll try not to do that. But they receive most unaccompanied, they're supposed to receive all unaccompanied children that are in U.S. immigration custody. So children are apprehended at the border by Customs and Border Protection, and then they are transferred over to the Office of Refugee Resettlement. On average, in the past, they have received about 6,000 to 7,000 children a year. And in fiscal year 11, they estimate they received over 14,000. So the numbers really are staggeringly high for an organization that was fairly steady for many, many years, despite the closing off of borders, despite new laws that people thought were going to change the flows. So at first, these numbers were really treated as an anomaly. And to try to accommodate them, ORR began opening what they called surge facilities along the border in Texas primarily. And they were really like emergency facilities. They were at YMCAs. Some of them were added on pieces of existing shelters. And at one point, they even were using an Air Force base outside of San Antonio. And this started to get a lot of press. And as Anita mentioned, a lot of people started talking to about it. A lot of rumors were flying, and we were getting a lot of phone calls. So we decided we had to go down and find out what was happening. We conducted focus groups with over 150 youth and talked to all sorts of officials, CBP, that's Customs and Border Protection, ICE, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, legal service providers, shelter staff, really everybody who was willing to talk to us, which was a lot of people actually. So what did we discover? Why is this influx occurring? The youth we interviewed consistently described increasingly dangerous situations back home, particularly, as Anita mentioned, in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And while, of course, these children described many of the reasons that we'd known of for years for their travel, which included gangs, poverty, and wanting to join family that were here in the U.S., over 77% of the participants stated that the sharp increase in violence, in particular gang violence, was the main reason that they were fleeing their countries. So clearly, while many of these kids are coming for the same reasons as before, there was really no question after these interviews that the increases in violence were a driving force and that there was a push factor occurring, not just a pull factor. One of the one example of what one of the kids told us really reflects this, I think. He said to us, "In El Salvador, there is a wrong. It's being young. You're stalked by gangs. Authorities beat and follow you because they don't trust you. They think that we're gang members. There are no jobs for young people because employers don't trust us either. It's better to be old." Our desk research that we conducted after interviewing these children really confirmed that there were increases in violence leading to these increased flows. Children feared not only gangs, they told us that they were afraid also of the authorities who, in their efforts to crack down on gang violence, were targeting youth as well. And girls also repeated increased violence and pressure from gangs, who often use gang rape as a means of both coercion and of retaliation. One 11-year-old girl told us that by the age of 9, she was paying gangs to leave her and her grandmother alone. By the time she was 11, she had saved enough money to come to the United States to escape them and said to us that whatever happened, she would not let herself be a victim of them. Again, all three countries stated that we have mentioned the primary sources of from which these kids come, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, all are experiencing shocking levels of violence. Honduras has become one of the most dangerous countries in the world, with the highest murder rate in the world at 86 out of 100,000 population. Political instability has led to a vacuum in which a lot of cartels stepped in. El Salvador also has only a slightly lower murder rate than Honduras, and also suffering from gang and drug cartel violence. And in Guatemala, we found not only high levels of this kind of violence, but also they've experienced two consecutive years of bad crops, which has led to economic crises and food crises in much of the country. So our conclusion really is that until conditions for youth in these countries changes substantially, we can expect that this new trend will continue. And we really, it's going to require a commitment, not just from the U.S. government and its immigration policies, but a much more regional approach that includes all of the countries of the region, including the Central American countries, Mexico, through which so many of these children pass. And we really need to start looking at it with a humanitarian lens, because it's not just an immigration problem. So in addition to asking the children that we spoke to about why they came and their journey, we also tried to look into the conditions in these surge facilities. At the time that we went, they were just starting to wind down and get a handle on what was happening. But things were really functioning in emergency mode. It was triage mode. And many of the children were receiving basic services, but often not everything that they really needed. And some of the kids we spoke to had been in custody for several weeks and not yet had the opportunity to talk to a caseworker or to make a phone call. So they were quite distressed. And the longer they had been in these facilities, the more emotionally distressed they were. From our observations and our conversations with both the children and the government officials we spoke to, it was clear that ORR in particular was overstretched and really struggling to manage the placement and transportation of all these children. They did not get a budget increase to handle twice as many children. And as you can imagine, in these times of budget crisis, that's a really tricky subject. So the one thing that they did end up doing at ORR is related to two things that have somewhat resolved the issue for the moment in terms of dealing with the crisis. They have contracted for more bed space, so they now have a total of 3,000 beds available for children, which has eased some of this backlog and the emergency shelter use. So they've been able to close the emergency shelters. One of the problems is in their rush to open as many facilities as possible to house the children, the facilities that they've contracted for are really quite institutional in nature. They are large facilities that hold a lot of children, which is really counter to current social work trends in how you care for children. One thing I should clarify with respect to kids is that it's a little trickier with children than it would be with adults. a lot of the initial NGO response to this flood of kids was, well, why are they detaining them at all? They should just be releasing them all. Well, the reality is that you can't, you know, come across a 14-year-old and then say, okay, here's a piece of paper, come to court in 3 months or in 2 years, bye. There is an obligation on the part of the government to care for these children and to find placement for them. Many of them have family or sponsors or somebody that they know in the U.S. who they can be reunified with, and eventually that is what ORR tries to do. So they really sped up the process for reunifying these kids and releasing them to family or sponsors, which ultimately is probably a good thing. Our concern is that we wanted to make sure that in doing so, they were not overlooking safety and protection concerns for these children. We have heard accounts of children who get released to people and then end up working from 7 a.m. till midnight every day, or you know, who aren't in the safest conditions. So, you know, family is one thing, but, you know, there are concerns of traffickers and smugglers who may not have the best interests of the children in mind. The other concern is that when you're releasing children very quickly, you really need to fill the gap and make sure that those kids are receiving post-release services so that you can make sure that they're getting to court and they're getting the relief that they may be entitled to, their fair day in court, right, which includes access to attorneys. The majority of children still go to immigration court with no attorney, despite some great organizations that have developed to provide them with pro bono services, such as KIND is one of those. So having said that, I'm going to pass it over to Jeffrey Cox, who joined us on this trip to the border and was able to interview some children. So he'll be able to give you some firsthand accounts and his impressions. And then when he's done, I'll come back and tell you a little bit about Border Patrol.
Thank you. Can you all hear me? Okay. I see people nodding out there, so I'll just carry on. So first of all, we wanted to thank the Women's Refugee Commission for continuing to involve us in this work. This is a very important project they're involved in, and we're just very appreciative to be a part of that. So thank you very much. As Michelle said, I had the opportunity to go down to Texas with one of our colleagues to do some interviews with Jennifer and Jessica, and we really covered, I believe, about six or seven locations where these children were being housed, and had an opportunity, as has been pointed out, to interview about 150 children. I was part of the group that went to the Lackland Air Force Base, where we interviewed a number of focus groups and some individual children as well. In general, the interviews that I participated in definitely back up what the main points that have been made already. The children in their home countries, which are, of course, mainly El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, are really being subjected to increasing levels of gang pressure and violence. And extortion in those countries, which is a large part of why they're coming up to the United States or attempting to at this point. Also, as Anita was pointing out, we heard many stories of the traumatic things that these children are going through as they travel up to the United States. The journey is typically partly by foot, partly by bus, and partly by train. And along the way, but primarily in Mexico, was our impression, they're victimized by police officials, by drug gangs, by other types of gangs. You can imagine how vulnerable they are. And, of course, there's appear to be quite a number of predatory-type groups and individuals that prey on them. When they get to the border, the children we interviewed reported very difficult and dangerous attempts to cross over the border, often led by coyotes who would either abandon them on the Mexican side, lock them in warehouses to extort money from them, take them across the border and abandon them in the desert without adequate water or food. Occasionally, some of the children reported that when they were able to reach a U.S. town, they would then be victimized by street gangs in the U.S. town, the same drug gangs that would be victimizing them on the other side of the border. So it was really quite a traumatic journey for a lot of these children, some of whom are quite young. They also reported a degree of rough treatment upon being captured on the U.S. side of the border. People being yelled at, some physical contact, their possessions being taken away, that sort of thing. And one can imagine in sort of a law enforcement type situation where people are trying to escape and run away, the sorts of things that go on, and the children reported those sorts of things that you would expect. When they were taken to the holding facilities, they were typically put in small crowded cells, which are kept quite cold, apparently, and there were quite a few complaints about that. The food is minimal, let's say. So they generally, by the time they get to the one of these proper holding facilities where there are more services set up for them, they're usually quite happy to be there and to be through with the journey, the border crossing, and the holding facilities at the Border Patrol. At Lackland, which again is the facility that I visited, this was part of a U.S. Air Force base. The children are housed in a building that's an older building. In fact, the plans for it are for it to be basically torn down and completely refurbished for the next group that's going to use it. So these are not deluxe conditions by any means. On the positive side, the children appeared to be physically safe. They were being adequately protected from anybody coming in from the outside. There seemed to be sufficient adult supervision to keep them safe from each other. They all reported getting basic medical care, nothing fancy, but they had all been examined. They'd all gotten vaccinations and that sort of thing. They all reported that they were being fed well. There might have been some complaints about the types of food and that sort of thing, but from what we could hear and from what we could see, those sorts of issues were being taken care of. Some of the problems we saw, one is that there's really little for them to do during the day. There's some limited access to recreation. There's some limited attempt to provide education for them while they're there. But you can imagine they're in a limited physical space with limited facilities for recreation. They have all different backgrounds and ages and educational backgrounds, so putting them in classes and that sort of thing is very difficult. Lackland was being managed by the Baptist Child and Family Service, and overall, I was impressed with the job they were doing. Now, I have to say that when we were there, the surge was coming to an end, and so they had probably built up facilities during the surge and oversight and social worker capacity and that sort of thing. And so there appeared to be adequate capacity in all of those regards while we were there, but that may not have been the case while the surge was on the upswing. But there did seem to be a fair amount of attention given to assigning the children to caseworkers who were attempting to locate custodians in the United States, preferably family members, who could then take custody of the children. That obviously was a delicate task because a lot of times the people who are the most likely custodians and the most appropriate custodians are reticent themselves to come forward and have contact with the federal government. So locating these people, building the trust to the point where the children could be handed off takes time. And as Michelle pointed out, some of the children are in these facilities for a long time, and they see other kids coming and being sent off more quickly, and it becomes a frustrating experience for them, and that sort of thing. So in any event, that's sort of the overview of the Lackland base. the other facilities that were visited were sort of had similar issues. Some were better, some were worse. In terms of the opportunities and the care provided for the children. But overall, those were my top impressions. Great. Turning it back to you, Michelle.
Great. Thanks. I'll just take it from there. Anita, thanks. Thank you, Jeffrey. So I'm going to backtrack a little bit to the point of apprehension. As alluded to by Jeffrey, the treatment children received at that initial entry into the United States when they're apprehended by Customs and Border Protection is quite different from what they experience once they get to ORR custody. Just by means of some terms, Customs and Border Protection is the overarching body, and underneath Customs and Border Protection, we have Border Patrol, which we hear a lot about. They cover areas between official ports of entry. So Border Patrol is usually the agency or the sub-agency that apprehends these children. Sometimes they may also be apprehended at ports of entry, official ports of entry, where they may present themselves or try to get in through some other means. And that body is called the Office of Field Operations. And they operate somewhat differently, so it gets a little bit tricky. But I'm generally going to be referring to CBP, which is the overarching agency, or Border Patrol, which is where we see where we hear most of these complaints from. But it's very difficult to know sometimes because the children don't always know who they're dealing with. And that is really important in terms of their ability to file complaints or tell people what's happened to them. I think one really important thing to start out with before I go into too much about the conditions at Border Patrol or CBP generally is that despite really excellent access given to us by ORR and even by ICE, both for this specific research project and generally speaking, CBP has consistently refused to give us or any other NGOs access to their facilities in any meaningful way and do not allow us to speak to any children or migrants in their custody. It makes it virtually impossible to do really good research into what's happening in those facilities, and it's a real sticking point for a lot of us. So as a result, the information that we have for the most part, and specifically for this report, the information we have about treatment in Border Patrol custody or in CBP custody really comes from children who are already in ORR custody. They're already transferred out of Border Patrol and in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, where they are generally speaking in a nicer place, getting better care. In some ways, that's a good thing because those children then may feel safer and more able to talk about their experiences. The really difficult part of that is that children rarely know where they were when whatever happened to them happened. So they will say, you know, it was an officer who grabbed me, but they don't know where they were. They don't know when. They don't know where they were taken. They don't know the names of these sectors or these Border Patrol stations. They never know the name of the officers that they were dealing with. And they often really don't even know what part of Homeland Security ORR it was. To them, there's no distinction between these different parts of the government. And occasionally you can get some information by asking the children what color uniform somebody was wearing or what kind of uniform. But even that can be quite tricky. To top it all off, conditions in these stations where they're held are such that the children often lose track of time. And I'll get to that in a moment. So the first piece, which again has been alluded to a couple times, is mistreatment by Border Patrol agents. We acknowledge absolutely out front that Customs and Border Protection have a very difficult job. It's a dangerous job. They are dealing with drug traffickers. They are dealing with cartels. They are dealing with arms traffickers and with national security issues. These are all part of their mandate. So very often, they approach their job as a law enforcement job, and coming across a lot of kids is not their ideal situation. But what we really have seen is that some of this this mentality of dealing with really dangerous situations flows over to treatment to really vulnerable populations that fail to take into account their protection needs and vulnerability. And this is especially the case since we have seen such a drop in the number of migrants coming from Mexico who are really from Mexico. Mexican migration has dropped to almost zero. And that is primarily for adults, but children as well from Mexico have dropped, while the numbers from Central America are skyrocketing. And it's consistent also with asylum applications that have gone up for Central America, whereas, you know, immigration cases generally in the other categories have changed as well. Sorry, I lost track of my thing for a second. So one example of the children we spoke to, many of them told us about how they had actually approached Border Patrol for help. Many of them ask Border Patrol for help because they're running away from smugglers or traffickers that they've encountered on the way in Mexico. And many of them actually look for Border Patrol because they are afraid they're going to die in the desert. I mean, the conditions of crossing are extremely dangerous, and many people find themselves without food or water, with infections from cactuses and really pretty horrific conditions, and will turn themselves into Border Patrol. And what's interesting is that many of these same children that told us that they turned themselves into Border Patrol looking for help also reported abuse by Border Patrol officers. And the things they described to us included physical abuse, such as hitting, kicking, shoving, having a gun held to their head, and even being tasered. One example of this is a 16-year-old boy, I think he was 16, who told us about being apprehended with the group of people he was traveling with. It was five people, including his guide and a pregnant woman. And when they were apprehended, they were all thrown down to the ground roughly and tasered before being handcuffed. And what really struck me with this boy's account was that he seemed primarily concerned that a U.S. official would taser a pregnant woman. He was less concerned about being tasered himself, but horrified and really shocked that this would happen in the place he thought was going to be his place of safety. We had another account of two girls, a 12 and 14-year-old, who were traveling together, who told us that they were kicked severely by Border Patrol when they were apprehended, to the point that the 14-year-old girl the next day was taken to the hospital. And she told us that she was too afraid to tell the doctor how she had injured herself because the Border Patrol agent who had kicked her was standing next to her throughout the entire physical examination. So it's yet another example of how difficult it is for these kids to tell their stories. They really don't know that they have anybody to tell them to. Again, why it's so important for monitors and outside parties to get access to these short-term Border Patrol stations. Children also reported consistently emotional abuse or mistreatment. A common story, we heard it again this time, but I've heard it many times before, is children telling us of their belongings, sometimes the only belongings they have in the world, being torn up and thrown away. And often in mocking and jeering tones. So, for example, one boy this time told us about how the Border Patrol agent mocked him and tore up the one picture he had been carrying with him of his mother, which for me is very moving as a mother. But these kinds of stories were consistently told by the children. And again, I should say that it wasn't just in this research trip that we heard these stories. These are really consistent with reports that have come out of numerous organizations who've been working at the border, and are well documented also in the previous report we did with ORIG called Halfway Home. In addition to treatment at the border, the conditions in Border Patrol stations are problematic, to say the least. It's widely known these stations are not ideal for long-term detention of any kind. They're really intended as holding cells for the short term. But even for the short term, they're no place for a child. They're concrete cells. They have no access to outdoor lighting. The lights are on 24 hours a day, which is where a lot of the time confusion comes from. Children really had a hard time knowing how many days they were in these facilities. They're very, very cold. Children universally refer to them as la hielera, a freezer. I've been in some of them in extremely monitored tours, and they are indeed really, 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 really cold. And I've been told that they're kept that way intentionally to keep the migrants sedated. There are no beds, really. Sometimes they provide what they call boats or canoes, which are these plastic things that you're supposed to sleep in. Many of the children in this trip told us that because of the crowding, overcrowding that was happening, because of the lack of beds, they were sometimes in these facilities for up to 2 weeks with no access to a shower, no proper place to sleep, and very overcrowded conditions. One child told us about having to take turns lying down for sleeping purposes. Yeah, I mean, the 24-hour light is actually found to be a torture tactic, frankly. Not implying that they're intentionally torturing people, but, I mean, I think a lot of this is because they just aren't prepared to house. It's just they're not thinking through the conditions and what it means if you're held there for a long period of time. And again, we acknowledge that it's not necessarily CBP's fault. They'll be very quick to tell you this, that the children were there for so long. They have made efforts over the years to decrease the amount of time that children are held in these facilities. But because of this increase in the numbers and because they weren't prepared for it, they were there for longer periods. And frankly, even if it's for a short amount of time, these conditions really aren't appropriate for the people that they're holding in them. So overall, it's clear to us from the research that we did, and more needs to be done to find out exactly what's going on and exactly how, you know, what we can all be doing to prevent these flows or to protect these children. But it's clear to us that the children are having really, because of push factors, at least as much, if not more, than for pull factors. You know, there's often this talk in U.S. immigration policy circles about push factors and pull factors, and you don't want to attract people. But it was very clear to us that kids were coming because of desperation, and they told us that. They told us that, you know, they felt they had a choice. Either they stay home where they know they're going to die, or they risk a journey that they know is going to be dangerous, but that they might survive. The U.S. government was, I'm sorry, and so we really need to sync our get more research into why and what we can do to stop this. The U.S. government was clearly unprepared for this increase in numbers, and we really are working with our U.S. border systems and our immigration systems on antiquated policies. They're really created to address an economic flow that they're trying to stop and discourage as opposed to a humanitarian and protection approach. And we really, that really needs to be changed because it's very clear that the people coming now, there's been a pretty drastic shift in the demographics of the population. And really we need to have a regional or transnational approach to migration that has a humanitarian lens on it so that we can really get at the root of these problems and address them and not just create this revolving door of dangerous situations where people aren't being protected. For ORR in particular, we really recommend that they take another look at the kinds of beds that they're creating for these kids and use less institutional facilities and more foster care and small group homes, even for the short term while they reunify them. And that they improve their monitoring and accountability. I mean, they do allow us to go into the facilities, which is fantastic, but we've really been trying to encourage them for years to institute their own kind of oversight processes because they have good policies, they're just not always followed. Moving facilities away from the border, currently most of their facilities, for a lot of complicated reasons, are located near the border where children are far away from any support system. There's a lack of resources. And they're frankly in danger still of this circle of traffickers. And finally, for ORR, there really needs to be a focus on providing legal representation for these children and post-release services, especially as they're being released quicker. For CBP, they really need to start screening and using more appropriate reception procedures for the migrants that they're seeing. And we really recommend that they partner with NGOs or other social service providers that have expertise in dealing with populations in need of protection. It's very clear to us from talking even to Border Patrol officers that they see themselves as law enforcement and they don't want that job. They have told us they would welcome having people come in who have the right expertise to screen and care for these populations. They really need to just put in some basic improvements in conditions, providing blankets, turning the lights down at night. I mean, there's simple things that could be done that would not compromise security. And finally, and maybe most importantly, to get some of these other things happening, there really has to be a drastic improvement in transparency, access to facilities for monitoring purposes, permission to speak to children and other migrants in these facilities, and most importantly, connected to that, accountability for abuses that are occurring. So I'll leave it at that and let Anita see if there's any questions.
So yeah, we have, how much time do we have? I'm sorry.
That much.
Yeah, we have 10 minutes for questions. So I'm wondering if anyone has any questions for either Michelle or Jeffrey. Yes, back there. Should we?
Hello? Hello?
Yes, somebody's.
Hello?
Hello?
I have a question.
Sure. What's your question? And then we'll get to you. Yes, please go ahead. Your question?
Okay. This is Laura Simich at the Beer Institute. Thank you for the great work. I have two questions. One is, have you observed efforts to identify children who are victims of trafficking? And the second question is, what efforts are made to identify the children who need mental health services?
Michelle, you want to take that one?
Yes, I'll take it. So, we have a lot of concerns about screening for trafficking, in particular with Border Patrol. Under the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, which is has been in place for many years now, actually, border officials are required to screen all children crossing the border, in particular Mexican children, because presumably other children would automatically go to ORR, but they are supposed to screen them to see if they're at risk of trafficking, in addition to any asylum screenings. And we have clearly seen that this is not happening over and over again. We found that when we went down and did the ORIC report many years ago, and that's reported in Halfway Home. And since then, when we've gone down and talked to border officials and talked to children, it's become very, very clear to us that that screening is not happening, and we think it's really problematic because it's been over 3 years since they were supposed to be doing it. For ORR, you probably know better than I do coming from Vera, but ORR does have screening forms and tools for children who are in their care to see if they may be victims of trafficking. And I can't really say to what extent those are working or not. We haven't had the opportunity to look into how effective those are. And then finally, I'm trying to remember what your next part of the question was.
Laura, were you
mental health? We found in Halfway Home, actually. Yeah, we found when we did the previous report called Halfway Home, that there really was a lack of appropriate mental health treatment programs for these kids. A lot of them really come with a lot of issues. I mean, if they haven't had, they haven't been victimized before coming, which many of them have been, many of them are en route, and they really have a lot of issues to deal with. We found at that time that a lot of the children were being severely over-medicated, so they were being treated with medications and sedated very often instead of receiving more therapeutic treatment. I know that since that report came out in our follow-up meetings, they have improved and opened some therapeutic facilities. But, you know, frankly, mental health care for children is a problem for everybody in this country. I'll just go ahead and put that out there. But that's my view. And so I think these kids are no exception. They're even more vulnerable and, you know, have more limited resources, I would say.
Yeah, and keep in mind the journey that both Jeffrey and I spoke about, and the condition they must be arriving in psychologically after enduring, even if they weren't themselves victimized in the way that was the most horrific ways we've described, they've witnessed it often. So they've witnessed girls or women being raped even if they themselves were not. So it's important. The woman in the back?
I work here in New York City with children who are detained by or in the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement in Dobbs Ferry, New York. And during this period of influx, we saw a huge shift in the ages of children placed in our facility. So previously, we were mostly working with children who were 14 years of age or older, with the understanding that children who were younger than that, specifically kids under the age of 12, were being placed in short-term foster care placements. during the summer, we saw numerous kids who were 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, an increase of younger children also who were girls placed in our facility. And so my question, Michelle, just in terms of the expansion of beds, if this increase in bed space has been allocated also to short-term foster care placements specifically for younger kids, or if you've looked at those numbers at all?
Yeah, I don't have what the exact numbers are, but that's exactly our concern. So as the numbers increase, the number of young children also increased. The foster care placement was very limited and got filled up very quickly. So a lot of younger children than normal. The norm for ORR is that any child under 12, they try to prioritize for foster care. And the same for girls, particularly pregnant girls. A lot of girls arrive pregnant either, and I hate to say it, most of it is from sexual assault, I think, along the way. But they usually tried to put those in foster care, but they got filled up fast, and there were more of them. And really, my concern is that the beds they added are primarily big institutional settings, even bigger than Dobbs Ferry. I mean, like facilities that have 200 kids or more, which is problematic. So I hope that they will continue to try to expand on the foster care and group home, but I think that needs to be, they need to hear that needs to happen.
Do you know if there's been a shift in the makeup as far as age goes, or is that just something they're seeing?
You know, I wish Jessica was here to see exactly. There's some breakdowns, but it stayed. We heard a lot of reports initially about a lot more young children, but I think percentage-wise it was probably about the same. But interesting, you know, it wasn't just the older kids that were coming in. We saw a percentage increase across the board, okay, is my sense. I'm not 100% sure. The report probably reflects it exactly.
Do we have any other questions in the audience? Sure, right here. Do you have the mic?
Yeah, I guess I wanted to understand this more. I'm sorry if you already explained it, but how long are the children spending in Border Protection or Border Patrol protection versus being in these other facilities? Like, what's the trajectory of that experience?
So under normal circumstances, when there wasn't this kind of emergency situation that they were not prepared for, children are by law required to be transferred out of CBP custody into ORR custody within 72 hours. It generally does happen. It did happen within that 72-hour period. There were always outliers, and it's very difficult to know for sure how often there's cases where they don't, because we have very little means of finding out. But generally speaking, they seem to be, in the past few years, really trying to comply with that 72-hour, and, in fact, doing it quicker than that. In fact, that was CBP's response to our previous report on conditions at Border Patrol stations, was not to improve the conditions, but to just say, we're going to get them out of here quicker. During the increase, before ORR was able to increase their bed space, there was really a backlog, and we heard about children being in CBP custody for 2 weeks or more. And then the average length of stay in ORR facilities used to be between 70 and 90 days, and now it's around 50 days. So it has gone down significantly as well because they've sped up that process.
Yes, over there.
So do you have a sense of programs that are happening in home countries, in Guatemala, El Salvador, to address the cause of this increased migration?
You know, I think this is an issue that my understanding is, at least in Guatemala, that is a issue that the First Lady is paying attention to. There is some movement on that. I mean, I don't know how it's going to turn out. There's a lot of, it's very, very preliminary right now, but not so much in the preventative sense, but in how to deal with them when they come back, when they're deported. But yeah, there have been some campaigns here and there, but I, to be honest, I don't see any major holistic approach yet that, I don't know if you've seen anything different.
No, there's a few little things.
Yeah.
So the U.S. government is now looking into, and other organizations are looking into ways of educating kids about what they might face if they leave. So, you know, that could be helpful in terms of preparing kids for the journey and making them maybe think twice about it. It may not help if they're really fleeing from danger, right? And then they're also, you know, I don't know if they're helping or hurting. I mean, all of these countries have anti-gang operations going on. And in Honduras in particular, now the U.S. government has been involved in some operations against the drug cartels that are, at least the way, there's a little bit of information in the report about it, but they're supposed to mirror somewhat the policies in Colombia, which frankly to me don't sound very good. And they actually seem to be, for the most part now anyway, they seem to be making it worse. Because as I said, a lot of the children talked about government anti-gang activities targeting them as the victims of gangs because they can't really distinguish.
Yeah, you hear a lot of talk about adolescent boys, Central American adolescent boys, as if they are a threat. I mean, it's really intense when you hear how people describe them. You know, especially if you're somebody who's had, you know, firsthand experience with them, it's just hard for you to imagine that this is how people are talking about them. And then I think that, you know, what Michelle made an interesting point, we just discussed, there is all this anti-gang, anti-drug trafficking, U.S. government involvement, and it's also paying for increased enforcement efforts in Mexico in particular. Some people have been describing it as sort of like an exportation of our border to the southern border of Mexico. And similar to the United States, you know, there is the result of some of these enforcement efforts is a funneling of people to the most dangerous means of migrating. And it's not that their intention perhaps is to
close off the border,
but it's with knowledge that what they're doing is funneling people to the most dangerous parts of the U.S.-Mexico border. This is leading the kids into more, you know, seeking more traffickers or
well, exactly. You know, it's made the whole thing more dangerous, right?
That's clear. I mean, I just conducted a round of interviews in Mexico and Central America, and it's clear. I mean, this is what's happening. So, you know, have we, you know, actually, I had the question for you, Michelle. You know, we talk about in the report what ORR you want to do with CBP, but what about the State Department? What role does the State Department have in addressing this? I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, I mean, we're really hoping that we can start building relationships with the State Department on this issue because clearly this is something that they should be looking at. And they have expressed interest. So I'm really hoping that this report helps us open that door. We have not traditionally, in my unit of the Women's Refugee Commission, dealt very much with that issue in that context. So we're really hopeful that this will be the beginning of that because I think that there's a very big role for them in so many aspects of this, right? Not just the kind of regional approach and the humanitarian migration piece of it, but also in the violence at the border, which really has become a bilateral problem.
Anybody else have questions in the audience? Yes, go ahead. Thank you.
Just one more question, and this is a question that's sort of continually been tossed around in our agency, just in our work here in New York. You were just discussing just sort of this massive influx that we weren't prepared to handle in terms of capacity, ORR capacity, and I certainly don't envy them with the task of trying to place so many kids essentially overnight. What we saw here in New York was an additional contract with another facility, as you were mentioning, Michelle, a very large facility with many beds, and the kids sort of arrived on one plane altogether and showed up. But now, just here in New York locally, we've actually seen the opposite. That facility is now completely empty. And so my understanding is that contract for those beds still exists. And you know, just sort of thinking about this, if you need to have that bed space available in the time of influx, but really the numbers are continually changing, what is your recommendation to ORR in terms of contracting bed space if, for example, the number goes back down to what we used to see, but knowing that it could go back up overnight all over again, just to prevent sort of housing kids in Air Force bases and YMCAs and sort of more temporary placements?
I think obviously those are questions that need to be thought out. And I think one of the things that we felt some frustration with when we were looking at this is that ORR was so swamped in trying to deal with the immediate emergency that they weren't able to think more kind of systemically about how to handle it in the more long term. I mean, I think eventually they now have these contracts that are for potential bed space, which is somewhat similar to ICE. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but they, you know, you can have contracts with people that are based on need, right? So, for example, even U.S. domestic foster care will have a lot of foster care families lined up. They may not need those foster care families all the time, and unfortunately, they probably usually don't have enough as opposed to an excess. But, I mean, there's ways to build up your capacity so that it's available when you need it, and then that way you don't have to rely on, you know, whatever it is you can find in the short term. I mean, one of the problems with the facilities that they ended up using in Texas for this, you know, when the numbers started increasing quickly, is that they were extremely expensive. You know, they basically used what was their emergency preparedness system was the Texas emergency preparedness system. So they were paying people huge amounts as though it was a state emergency at YMCA. And, I mean, they were paying people who were trained emergency personnel. It was very expensive on a very limited budget, and it wasn't ideal. So I think, you know, they can think through, and maybe they're on their way to that since they've kind of done it one time. But again, I would hope that they stay away from those big institutional facilities because we just don't see good things happening in those.
Do we have any other questions? Well, thank you very much. I guess that will be it for today. Thank you so much for coming. And
thank you.
Thanks to the Women's Commission and to Jeffrey.
And thank to you, Oric. Guys.
And to Oric. For this lovely space and all the hard work they've done on this issue of unaccompanied minors. Thank you.